This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Go.
Hello and welcome to this Futurenauts Topia special with him, Mark Stevenson, and me, Ed Gillespie. Topia is a brand new digital magazine where anything goes, as long as it's good. And we are the Futurenauts, a couple of futurists, authors, recovering sustainability guys who love the planet. Some of you may know that we do a podcast with comedian and professional worrier John Richardson. We talk about what's wrong with the world, what needs to be done to sort it out, and wrestle with the bigger picture. We're excited to collaborate with Topia to bring you this regular podcast series of cosmic chats, candid conversations with some of the remarkable planetary defenders keeping our planet cool.
Topia magazine takes a kaleidoscopic look at culture, positive impact, and outrageously good stories covering everything from design to conservation. Why? Because we might be overstretched, overproduced, overwhelmed, but we're not over tomorrow. If anything will save the world, it's falling in love with it. Topia is created by our wonderful friend Lisa Goldapple, who, by the way, you should never go on a night out with because you may not come back with your sanity intact. But she takes you on a journey around the world's wildest edges as a vibrant guide to an extraordinary world in metamorphosis. It's all a bit trippy. Think Lewis Carroll meets Tina Fey in the canteen at National Geographic. Season one is themed on the Big Bang, so expect stories of stardust and supervolcanoes and polar explorers and astrophotographers and tentacles and, according to Lisa Goldapple, talking beavers and dopamine fireworks. No mushrooms are necessary, apparently.
No. In the name of all things good, we're launching this Topia series by turning the tables on our very good friend and Futurenaut compadre, John Richardson. We're interviewing him, something he doesn't allow to happen very often, particularly about his comedy, in a cosmic chat about turning difficult times into laughs, his personal Big Bang epiphanies, and what a world of good looks like. So let's get Futurenaughty with Topia and John Richardson.
God, it sounds awful. We're turning the tables, and he's usually the star, but this time he's the victim.
Victim is big.
I'm gonna start, John, because there is an argument that being a comedian means that you actually have to be a bit more aware or a bit more observant than other people. You see things that other people don't, or you see things in a way that other people don't. Is that true? Are you special? Do you see a bigger picture?
No, I don't think so. I think...
You do know that you're supposed to have said yes there.
Oh, really? Okay. Yes, I think so. You just edit out the first one, can't you? You don't really need me. You could have sent me a script.
Certainly, when you go and see a comedian, they will say something. You go, I have never thought about it that way. And that's part of what makes me laugh. So you must be seeing things that other people don't see.
Yes, but what you're seeing when you see... I mean, if you stumble across an open mic night and you see a comedian doing that, that person is gifted. What you mean when you say you see a comedian, and I think you see them on tour when they have probably at that point spent 1,000 hours distilling every thought they've had to the most interesting. And I would say that certainly you too, I know, and most people, if you went through a refining process of all your ideas and thoughts and funny things you'd said in the pub, and all a comedian does is say that again 100 times. And most people move on and go and do a valid job. And we just think, oh, I'm going to travel to every town in the UK and say that thing. So we all think, I just thought of it.
So it's basically like Baudelaire. You drink an ocean in order to piss a teacup, and then you go and piss in that teacup all over the country.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, the teacup is nice. And as long as nobody saw you drink the ocean, then you've got away with it.
This is, I mean, up until this moment, you know, I really admired you.
This is why I don't do these interviews. There's so many interview shows for comedians and I get asked to do all of them and I haven't done a single one for this reason.
We are honoured. We are truly honoured. But if we go back to the origins, John, so when did you first think you might want to be a comedian? And what made you think that was a valid choice? Because was it sort of an accidental thing? Was it an epiphany? Was there a big bang revelation?
That's very interesting because those to me are two completely different questions. So it wasn't a point of thinking I wanted to be a comedian and questioning whether that was a valid choice or not. I knew very young that I wanted to be a comedian. I knew I wanted to make people laugh. It then took 10 years for me to work out that that was a possible career because where I grew up, there just were no comedians. You know, I grew up in Lancaster, which is a big city. You know, I've got a lot going on, university, and there's a lot of trades there. It never occurred to me for even half a second. I didn't know there were open mic nights. I didn't know comedians did university campuses. I didn't know comedy existed beyond buying a Lee Evans VHS or a Jack T VHS. I just thought those people had been handpicked in a way we do with politics rather than have it open to everyone. If you go to the right school, you get to be a politician. And in the same way, I just thought, well, somebody found Lee Evans and made him a comic. Someone found Joe Brand and made her a comic. You know, I didn't know it was a career. So I've got a diary entry from when I think I was about 13 saying I really want to be a comedian, but I think I'll be a teacher because I didn't know, you know, that to me was like saying I want to be an astronaut. It felt just it wasn't real. And it wasn't till I went to university and dropped out of university and then did a couple of jobs that I found out about open mic nights and thought, oh, well, of course I'll try that. And as soon as I tried it, I thought, oh, I should have been doing this the whole time.
Let's just pull at that a bit more because you said when you were 13, you said you wanted to be a comedian. Why?
I knew that the thing I was best at was making people laugh. And I knew that, and that I say the thing I was best at, that was a short list. But the thing that I always wanted to do was I always wanted to get a laugh in any conversation. And I'd probably just gone through, I mean, when I was 13, my sister's 5 years older than me. So she'd gone through difficult teenage years and she bore the brunt with my mother of me learning what the difference between a joke and a controversial statement was. Those were some dark years. Those were some real, so I've got a reaction there, but not a laugh. And that remains to this day the skill I think most comics need is to tell the difference between a laugh and a reaction because anyone can get a reaction, but it's a real skill to get a laugh. And, you know, the ooh noise I think is quite easy to get. You can just say something horrible and an audience will make that noise. But a laugh is such a different sound. It's such a pure sound. And, you know, a rolling laugh and that shrieking laugh and the snorting laugh, you know, those are the sort of things I'm mining for. Those are the diamonds that you're looking for.
John Richardson's Museum of Laughs.
Yeah, snort miner.
Now, it's fair to say that you are quite famous. How do you not go bonkers? Like, you are sort of recognisable in the street famous, and you were on the TV quite a lot, too much actually for my liking, but there you go.
Mine too.
How do you stay sort of grounded when you are actually put on a pedestal? And in fact, your career kind of depends on you being watched and seen and admired and liked, you know. How do you not go complete nuts?
Well, thanks for implying that I haven't. I would say certainly my comedy depends on me being, you know, uncomfortable and different anyway. And I think also, nobody's as famous as they think they are. I think it becomes a madness. If famous means some people look at you and 1 in 100 will come up and say hello, and in my experience be exclusively nice, that's it. Pick your team. You know, you can. I'm not denying there's a sort of attraction to thinking you're that famous. It becomes a sort of addiction, I think, because it's nice if you say to people, oh, you'll have to send a car, and they do send a car, and it's nice. Actually, if the car doesn't turn up and you get on the train and you find you're surrounded by commuters who aren't even looking at you, you've suddenly come crashing down to earth quite quickly. So, you know, and I have a daughter. I can't tell my five-year-old daughter that I'm too famous to go to Jungle Jim's play centre for her friend's birthday. She just doesn't care. She sort of knows I'm on telly because every now and again she'll come up to me and say, excuse me, are you John Richardson? Which I find hilarious.
What has being a comedian told you or taught you about the human condition that you might not have realized if you'd become something like, well, let's say a chef or something else? What is the unique insight into the human condition that comedy brings?
Well, I mean, a chef, you bang on there, Ed, because a chef is what I would have become, I think, had I not become
really?
Yeah, that's what I was doing when I started comedy.
You see, I knew that when I wrote the notes. I knew that John
Yeah, I would have been a very angry. I mean, whatever comedy does teach you, chefing teaches that if you lock testosterone adult men in a basement with no windows, they get angrier.
And knives. Sharp knives
and heavy pans.
And turn up the heat.
Yeah, get some gas on there. Get some carbon monoxide floating around in the atmosphere. Make them stink of onions. Send down pretty people from the outside world. They send the pretty waiting staff down to pick up the plate from the trolls and then head back up.
Sound like you really miss it.
I mean, the most important thing I've got from comedy is a concrete process by which the worst things that happen to you or happen in the news or happen globally become a punchline. I mean, that's the alchemy, when you can take a difficult thing, turn it into a routine that makes other people laugh night in, night out on a tour. It's such an exhilarating feeling. Mm. And it's, you know, I don't say that out of any sense of that I'm doing a charitable service. It's vanity and it's how I pay my bills. But as a process to go through, you know, I literally start a tour thinking, what are the things that have happened to me in the world in the last 2 years that I want to talk about? And you refine your opinions and experiences of those things until all they are is a series of sentences that make people laugh. And that process is so, so rewarding for me as an individual that, you know, I think everybody should be able to do that. And I think counselling can do the same thing, talking about an experience and turning it into something, turning it into a learning process. Mm. Is the same thing, but it's absolutely, and you know, I've spoken to friends, my friend Mark, you know, when he's had difficult times, he says now, I know I'll always be all right because I can go and do stand up and I can go and turn difficult things into laughs. There might not be laughs on Live at the Apollo. There might be literally you go to the pub at the end of your street and do it. And I know loads of people, you know, from when I started, they're never going to become comics. They know they never become comics. They just do stand up 2 or 3 times a year. And it becomes a part of their arsenal for dealing with the world.
That's very interesting, because when I was a stand up, I got asked to do a show about the theories of humour, which was like being handed a poison chalice. It was at the Science Museum. And I think it was E.B. White who said, analysing humour is like dissecting a frog. Nobody much cares and the frog dies. But nonetheless, I kind of went for it. And one of the theories of humour is this theory of emotional release, in that the comic, by making jokes about something that you find difficult to confront, releases you of some kind of cognitive sort of knot. And it's that releasing of the knot that makes you laugh out loud. And the other thing that it strikes me about is that you said that, you know, it's good for your mental health. But, you know, when I was on the circuit, and obviously I know a few comics from that time and have stayed friends with a few, it seems to me that for a lot of comics, it's not good for their mental health. They do go slightly bonkers and they're self-absorbed. So you've obviously turned it into something useful and helpful.
I think that's the difference between the art of creating comedy and the fact of being a comedian. I think the fact of being a comedian can send you mad. It's a brutal, almost gladiatorial. When you're doing club nights, you know very well who's got the biggest laughs. There is no interpretation about it, and that can be very damaging. You know, some of the comics I've gigged with who've had the hardest time are doing things they believe in, but they're not as accessible as some of the other acts that they're on with, and they're watching people surpass them. All that stuff in any job, you know, you two both have, you know, deliberately entered realms that are challenging and tried to instigate big changes in the world, and you suffer the slings and arrows as a result of that. That process is going to be very difficult for you, even if I think you would both say broadly the careers you have now are more fulfilling than things you've done before. That doesn't mean you are immune from wanting to advance and feel like what you're doing is having an impact.
Mm. Yeah.
We're like the Jerry Sadovitz of sustainability consultancy.
There's a reference. So anyone listening can go and Google Jerry Sadovitz and have a look at some stuff and then come back to the podcast with a new view of Ed and Mark.
But this leads on to our next question, which is might be revealing, which is, do you have any comedy heroes? And if so, who are they and why?
There's very little I don't like. You know, I'm a sort of completist. I will watch everything. The comics that made me want to be a comedian were Billy Connolly and Lee Evans, I would say, because of what it felt like watching them with my family. I'd watch them with my mum and my sister and my nan when she came to live with us. And those comics who could make all four of us laugh the same. That was such a powerful thing to, you know, Lee Evans's routine about people keeping carrier bags in drawers and carrier bags within carrier bags. I mean, I watched my sort of 90-year-old triple bypass recovering grandmother and my mum and my sister nearly die watching that, all three of them. And that was
one of the happiest moments of your life.
Oh, absolutely. I want a piece of that. I want to be giving people hiccups and emphysema and whatever else I can do. So, you know, that sort of unifying comedy and, the silliest stuff. I thought when I started comedy, I thought I was going to be a lot more slapstick because I love Lee Mack and the stuff I watched was Rick Mayall. At even very young, I watched Pee Wee Herman just on a loop, just trying to work out why it was funny and what was funny about it. I obsessed over pratfalls and fart noises. And, you know, my mum will tell you it was just an absolute nightmare. And my first ever comedy set was written longhand because I'd never done a gig before. So I wrote my set out longhand and I've still got it upstairs somewhere. It says on it, brackets, comedy fall onto stage, ? Close brackets. And I just thought, well, I'll just see the vibe, you know, I'll judge the room. And if it feels right, I'll do a comedy fall onto stage. And I knew then, and I still maintain it now, if I'd have done that well, nothing would have been funnier than convincing people you've fallen over onto the stage. I still think it's the funniest thing. When I look back over my great comedy memories, they are people I care about falling over.
Joins me there. Interestingly, John, what you're saying is kind of about universality. It's the bringing together of people that is your joy, you know. And if that is over your own misfortune, making yourself the butt of that joke, then you're happy to do that. You don't want to be. What's his fucking name?
There you go. You've proved the point. You don't want to be that guy. I do not. You can't even remember his name. That's how much I don't want to be him.
Bill Hicks. You don't want to be Bill Hicks.
I just want to get the most laughs I can. So, you know, I used to live with Russell Howard. Those times driving around in crummy cars back from awful gigs, and we would just talk, you know, both just hunting for I believed there was the perfect gag, but I don't believe that anymore, but I believed there was a joke that everybody in the world would laugh at, and that our job was to veer towards that as much as we can.
Oh, that's got to be, surely that's got to be your big movie debut, isn't it? You and Russell in search of the perfect joke in a car. And
yeah,
and then you find it and you're about to say it and the film ends.
Absolutely. Full Sopranos, blackout, too. Yeah. Powerful. For me, I have to believe that my favorite thing in stand-up is doing a preview night and saying something you've never said before. And I can't write stand-up in my office because it will be the most depressive, horrific stuff, because that's where my brain tends when I'm in a room on my own. I have to go to a gig and look at an audience and think, right, I have to make these people laugh. And saying something you've never said before that you know is going to work for the rest of the tour is my favorite thing in the world. It never would have happened if I hadn't driven to Warwick on that Thursday night and got up in front of that audience in those circumstances and come up with that ad lib. That ad lib you will then go on to say every night on the tour. So you might have, you know, 10,000 people. If you do that gag on live at the Apollo, 4 million people might laugh at that joke. And it came from that little moment. And that's my favorite bit. Every time I tell it after that, I get more and more bored with it until, frankly, I hate it and my own existence.
Mm. So what we're saying is Lancaster, not funny. Warwick, very funny.
It was an odd one to pick, wasn't it, Warwick?
Yeah.
Not a funny sounding name. I should have said Kidderminster. That's what Rick Mayall would have said, Kidderminster.
Kidderminster is funnier.
John, much more now you're using your comedy to help bring bigger issues to a wide audience. You know, when Mark and I worked on Ultimate Warrior, where we all first met, you know, there was a whole section on flu pandemics in September 2019. Yes. How do you think about putting something important in something funny now? Because obviously you're doing more of it, and perhaps on the forthcoming tour, there'll be even more too. You know, how do you bring those key humanitarian challenges into being funny?
I'm not going to lie, it is really hard. It is still the biggest challenge in stand-up. I mean, Ultimate Warrior was, you know, it was a godsend having you two come in and say, these are things you need to talk about. And then you've got the entire arsenal of a TV production company in terms of, you know, games you can build, VTs you can film, things like that. And you don't have the same need for a gag rate that you do live. I am heavily influenced by the two of you and the topics that we've talked about on the podcast, and I do feel a responsibility.
Yeah, and I now feel a responsibility to all John Richardson fans. We're really sorry. We didn't ask him to do it. We've probably ruined him forever, and we apologise wholeheartedly now for ruining your favourite comedian.
Well, I mean, I did two previews this week, and the 15-minute routine that is building is about my hemorrhoids. So I don't, you know, don't worry that you've influenced me too heavily. I'm not going to be jettisoning the hemorrhoid routine to do a 10-minute routine about the future of carbon drawdown. So when I say I'm influenced by the two of you, I mean, I feel a pressure to do that. But if I can't make it funny, I won't be doing it.
Yeah, the future of piles.
As much as I want this tour to feature material about how we need to shape the future, if I make the tour really funny and I become more well known, and then I use that popularity to do things like our podcast, that is a better use of my time. And it's really tempting to just go straight at it and say, right, I'm going to put a routine in the tour about that. But the longer goal has to be, how do I have the most influence? And I have to accept, as frustrating as it is, people don't want that from me. They don't want to turn on the telly and see me and think, oh, this is going to be a 10-minute conversation about this thing. They want to see me and be made to laugh. And through that, I can then every now and again say, I wish you would listen to this, or I want to make a program that has this as an element of it. Mm-hmm. And it's a slower process, but I, you know, being more realistic and being a bit older, I think that's the better route for me.
And so here's a sort of a mean question, but does the world need comedians? What are the best things a comedian can do for the world, for the future?
I think a balanced and happy world maybe doesn't need comedians, but an imperfect and troubled world certainly does. And that seems to be the one that we're going to live in. You know, sometimes at the start of a gig, I'll say, thank you for coming. And it's an admission of, you know, defeat, really, because you've admitted that you're not happy in your lives. And you have to pay someone to make you laugh because your lives are tragic and hideous. You're not happy with the person you're with, but you don't dare say it to them. So you've come to watch me pick apart my relationship so that you can get some sort of joint release because you didn't speak to your partner about the way they load the dishwasher.
And I think we should snippet that a bit and put it out as a trailer for your next tour.
Yeah. And how miserable must you be that I'm the solution? My God. But yeah, that is the purpose you serve. You know, I'm still a fan of stand-up more than I'm a stand-up. And when certain comics I hear are going on tour, you know, Kevin Bridges is one. I'm not a comedian when I hear that Kevin Bridges is going on tour. I just think, oh God, I can't wait to see that because I'm going to laugh loads in that hour and a half. And that's going to make me feel better. And I'm going to look forward to that for months. What do you think the role of comedians is? Because we talk a lot about... I think our partnership came together because you two believe that we have a role to serve in disseminating this information and making it accessible.
I think there's a lot about pricking the bubbles of pomposity.
So you came to the biggest prick in the business.
I mean, I think it's something I say a lot, but, you know, people laugh at the truth. So I think you can get to the truth in a way that is kind of non-threatening. Like, you can use humour to say something that people will thank you for. Whereas if you told it to them straight, they would have punched you in the face and asked you to leave.
What's it like being married to another comedian, John? Is it kind of like brilliant laugh a minute knockabout and all hilarity from wall to wall in the Richardson household? Or is it like a horrific, dark, twisted nightmare?
Well, I mean, taking Lucy out of the equation for a minute, what do you two think it would be like being married to me? We've been married 7 or 8 years now, and it's getting to that point where you just suddenly realise, oh, we're doing this. We're sort of slowly, efficiently becoming a team who understand each other better. And there are jokes that I made in the first couple of years of our relationship that I don't make anymore. things I used to think were funny that I've been educated on by my wife that I don't need to do or say anymore. But still the funniest thing is when one of us falls over or accidentally farts. To go back to a recurring theme, you can have all the satire you like. We can sit and watch the news in the morning and lambast the politicians. But if I get up from a chair and fart, that's the funniest thing that's going to happen all day.
So, talking about family, you've got a daughter together. Have you explained to her what your job is?
We've told her that we make people laugh, that that's our job. I think she's too young to understand that that's weird.
So this is all very well and nice. Okay, so you're painting a very lovely picture here. But just to get sort of slightly serious for a bit. You've talked about being very unhappy in the past, having a bit of OCD, but you seem pretty okay now. But then you just recently you said, like, if I sit in a room by myself and try and write comedy, it's going to go to a very dark place. So that's why I kind of write in front of an audience. So
yes,
clearly this side of you that you know can and has in the past been in an unhappy, kind of pretty unhappy place, you know. What do you do to stay happy? Or how do you, you know, because you seem generally, and maybe it's just the side you showed to me in there, but you seem generally to be pretty well balanced and pretty okay these days.
Yeah, I am at the moment. I'm certainly more stable now than I've ever been. And I would just count the early stages of our marriage as still, you know, some instability there. I am more stable. Partly having a child is, you know, on a sort of micro level. I mean, I notice it most when Leeds lose, and I don't mean this to sound as pathetic as it does, but there's nothing like getting home from a game and seeing your child to make you realise how ludicrous it would be to carry that anger and disappointment into the next half an hour. And I used to sulk. I mean, as a kid, I would sulk for days after Leeds lost.
You must have sulked a lot as a child.
They lose. Yeah, they used to lose a lot. I mean, the thing I did that has been the most useful to my sort of mood being a bit more consistent is having counselling. It took me until I was 30, but I had counselling, and that's, I guess, because I had a couple of friends who I sort of knew well enough to be a bit more honest about, you know, when I was down, what that felt like. And they said, oh, that's not normal. I always thought everyone felt like it. And when I explained it, they said, oh, that's not, I don't ever feel like that. So I followed up on it and I had some counselling. It was just the best thing I've ever done in my life.
Did you try and make your therapist laugh?
No, God. I arrived. You couldn't have a more stereotypical angry little man. It was a nice, she had a little sort of home office in the back of her house, in the bottom of her garden. It was next to a cemetery. So I used to go and have my session and then walk around the cemetery for a couple of hours in the rain afterwards, mulling over what we talked. There was a chair in the room and there was a bed. And obviously we start in the chair, just sort of chatting generally and getting to know each other. And she would say, as you become more comfortable with the session, what's going to happen is I'm going to ask you to lie on the bed and not look at me and just look up. And then we'll be able to go to more interesting places. And I could see by the bed there was a bin with tissues in it. And I said, I'm not going on that bed because you're going to make me cry. It was such a cliched, angry little man state. I mean, it must be what you learn in the first session of wanting to become a counsellor. You know, I think she instantly knew everything that was wrong with me from that comment. But I just kept that up. I was like, I'm not, because you'll make me cry. And I'm not paying you to come here and cry and then go and walk around a cemetery. So I treated it like going to the doctors. I was like, you prescribe the thing that I need. And it wasn't like that. It was a process of realizing that it was just about understanding why you are the way you are through her asking the right questions. But the first sessions were not funny at all because she wouldn't talk until I talked. It drove me mad. She would wait. I don't know what the name for that kind of therapy is, but she would wait for me to talk. And we were having a couple of sessions a week at the beginning because she said I needed it.
It sounds quite lazy.
I would sometimes be silent for about 10 minutes and then I'd say, this is fucking insane. I'd say, what are you going to do if I don't talk for the hour? Yeah. You're just going to bill me for the hour and I'm going to go home.
It's the silent treatment. I mean,
yeah, because we'd have had one session where we talk about some quite intense stuff from the past. And then I'd come back 2 days later, I was like, you must have something to say about what I said. You know, if I took my car to the garage and they just stared at it, I said, well, what do you think's wrong with it? It would drive me insane.
But so listening to you talk, actually, what, you know, therapy is as you said, it's a kind of engaging with difficult stuff. And actually, you've said of the podcast that we all do together that when we talk about climate change or inequality or all the things that are wrong with the world, you've said that you've actually found that has cheered you up in a strange way. Could you talk us through that?
Yeah, I think acknowledge it. I think we all are in a really odd state at the moment where we know exactly what is wrong with the world and what needs to be done. You know, there are obviously intricacies within that, and the podcast is illuminating in terms of systemic change that's needed and how things are linked. But in terms of what we need to do to tackle a lot of the issues, we all know, and we're just pretending that we either aren't ready to deal with it or that we don't know. And you cannot do that. And I think a lot of people are drifting around. I mean, my favorite one was the fashion episode because it had such fascinating take-home facts in it. It was really refreshing to hear how easily you can change things in terms of a damaging industry. And because I don't ever buy new clothes and I walk around looking like a tramp, from minute one, I got to feel smug because it doesn't involve me. So that was the best one.
Do you know what's, you know, slightly upsetting about that is like we're just about to start planning series four and you're saying your favourite episode was quite early and on series one.
Yeah, well, you keep talking about things now that I have to do to change and that I don't like that as much as, you know.
But no, the thing you have said quite a lot is that by engaging with these difficult issues, you actually feel suddenly you can grasp hold of them and then they're not so, even if they're big, they're now kind of manageable because you can think about them and do something about them and change things.
Yeah, you become part of the solution rather than, you know, outside of it. However small that thing is, it's very empowering and, you know, it's invigorating, feeling like in little ways you are part of fixing things.
Mm-hmm. So what's your world of good, John? Perhaps you just complete the following sentences. So in my world of good, everyone has read which book?
Oh... so you want a book that's going to make people better. Yeah. I mean, the book I read the most is It by Stephen King, but your listeners are not going to go away and read that as a book that is going to help.
What draws you back to that? That's interesting.
Absolute escapism.
Yeah.
I mean, abject horror that makes you, however bad things are in this world, there's not a mad clown going around killing everyone.
Have you seen Boris Johnson?
Oh, very nice. There's your trailer. And it's a book about friendship and what it is to grow up. And I think I see a lot of Lancaster in Derry where the book is set, where there's a lot going on, but there's a lot not being talked about as well. And I think most towns in the UK actually have a lot in common with that, where, you know, the race episode of our podcast was absolutely excoriating in that, you know, I come from an area that is so closely linked to cotton and therefore slavery, and none of that is discussed in any meaningful way for a generation coming through to be empowered to at least understand where they come from and what that means, to just break down those barriers and have a factual conversation about who we are and why we are how we are. There's that alluded to in it. I think it's an absolute masterpiece. I think there's so much in it. It's a lovely long book and I listen to it, you know, once every couple of years and I take something new from it every time. Mm-hmm. I think Stephen King is a master at taking tensions that we feel and stories about what it is to grow up and what it is to lose friendship and be a different person. He manages to put that in a horror book.
So in your world of good, everyone has watched which film?
Oh.
Is it by Stephen King? Just going to go on.
The film I would say that everybody needs to watch is, or is it, I think the film I lean on the most is Home Alone. You know, but I'm now wondering how quickly I can cobble together an erudite answer about how Harry and Marv represent climate change and systemic change, and Kevin is us sort of stuck at home feeling like we've been left to make all the decisions for ourselves.
Oh.
Are you buying that?
Wow, you've just taken it to a whole new philosophical level.
Yeah, I think Home Alone is an absolute classic. And I think, you know, when he eats that cheese pizza, what he's saying is, you've got to be the change you want to see in the world. Do you want artsy answers?
No.
We want the truth.
Yeah, this is really, there's not coming out well for me, this conversation, when you ask me what I represent. Could I change my book answer to Of Mice and Men?
any thinkers, gurus, philosophers, commentators that you think everybody should have a knowledge of?
When I was in my, this gets mocked a lot, but when I was, I would say, in my most damaged state, so I just dropped out of university and I was chefing in Bristol and doing three jobs so that I didn't have any time to think in between. I was a breakfast chef in a hotel, then I went to a pub and did the lunch shift, and then I would drink four cans of Orangeboom in my garden and read the paper, and then I would go to an evening job. The things I started to read then were Paulo Coelho, which is, I mean, now I look back, is so, it seems sort of GCSE level emotion. I would write down quotes from his books that I like and stick them on my kitchen cupboards, which I thought was perfectly normal until I invited some friends around. Oh dear. I had like a set of felt tips and I would write them in ways. So one of the quotes was, "You don't drown by falling into water. You only drown if you stay beneath the surface." Ooh. So I wrote that sort of, I wrote the top line and then I wrote falling going down. And then the rest going across as if it was sort of in water. And one was something like, be secretive in your plans and transparent in your actions. So I wrote like secretive and I put it behind a little flap. So you had to lift a flap to see it. And I had them all over the kitchenette in the bedsit I was living, where there was literally plants going through the walls. I mean, it looked exactly how it sounds. It looked like a desperately unhappy man.
Yeah, you talk a lot about being single for a long period of time. I've never understood, never understood why. Yeah. But now I feel I'm maybe getting an inkling.
What could be sexier than coming back to the bedsit of a man with Paulo Coelho Warrior of Light quotes all over his kitchenette, a sofa that folds into a bed where you can still reach the pan with the simmering corned beef hash that you've just eaten on it. I mean, what a catch I was. Lucy often says to me, I wish we'd met earlier. And I have to say to her, no, you don't. I think if we'd have met 10 minutes before we met, you'd have hated me.
Okay, final question. Last song on earth, Topia call it. What's the song you want to be playing you out?
Well, I'm a big believer in sort of confronting your emotions. And as much as I admire people who say they want their funerals to be celebrations, and you know, I think I want people to be fucking devastated when I'm gone. You know, just get it out of your system, have a good old cry. When I first saw Anthony and the Johnsons singing Hope There's Someone, and it was a moment of such instant connection with a voice and a song. I like really sad music to the point where I'm not allowed to sing around the house. My five-year-old just doesn't understand. She lives in a world of Barney the Dinosaur and songs about farts and colours and rainbows. She doesn't understand why you would listen to a song about a ghost coming to take a dead man down a black river.
Why is Daddy singing Hurt by Johnny Cash again?
Oh, beautiful, yes. Oh, you're making me want to get hammered and turn all the lights off. I feel so bad now because you started with such a lovely speech about how this podcast was supposed to represent beautiful changes and the things we can take with us to make the world a better place. And it's ended with me saying, let's get shit-faced and put Johnny Cash on. That album he made where you could hear he was dying. That one. Oh, God, I'm so sorry.
Well, you know, it's what we've come to expect from you. And I think it remains only for us to say thank you, John Richardson. You're a lovely, lovely man.
Thank you, John.
Ditto. Thank you, gentlemen.
So there we go. As we leave John with Johnny Cash, I would also like to say thanks to you for listening. If you have ever wondered just what it is this mind bender of a universe is all about, or want to be entertained with inspiring positive stories, follow Topia at World of Topia on all the usual social media channels and fall down the rabbit hole on worldoftopia.com, where you can sign up to the newsletter, which is called A World of Good. And it is good.
You'll hear from us again in season two. We are lining up a guest as we speak. Until we meet next, remember to look up at the stars and dream. Topia editor Lisa Goldapple has told us to end on a funny sign-off. So, bang bigly until season two. We'll see you then. Hopefully not too sore.